Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter and Dorothy Gundy. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
The United States has launched 5 separate dispute actions at the World Trade Organization against Canada, China, the European Union, Mexico, and Turkey. The U.S. says these countries wrongly placed tariffs on U.S. products. The tariffs would involve a combined $28.5 billion worth of U.S. exports. They were ordered in reaction to U.S. tariffs announced in March. However, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says the latest tariffs are illegal under WTO rules. The Trump administration has said American national security interests justified tariffs it placed on imported aluminum and steel products. It said the tariffs are meant to protect the U.S. steel and aluminum industries from low-cost imports from other countries. But the administration argues the tariffs put in place by the 4 countries and the EU are not permitted because they are not based on national security. Under WTO rules, countries decide what their national security interests are. But the group also dissuades countries from overuse of that justification to avoid abuses. Lighthizer said, "Instead of working with us to address a common problem, some of our trading partners have elected to respond with retaliatory tariffs designed to punish American workers, farmers, and companies." The World Trade Organization describes itself as the only global international organization dealing with trade between nations. There are trade agreements between countries or groups of countries that also set rules for international trade. These include the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. But WTO officials point out that these agreements are not designed to deal with big issues that affect many countries or individual industries across borders. The WTO was established in 1995 following years of negotiations. The talks began at the end of World War II and involved more than 100 countries. The group has added more large economies in recent years, including China in 2001, Vietnam in 2007, and Russia in 2012. The body, which is based in Geneva, has a general council that includes all its members. The council carries out the business of negotiating, observing trade conditions, and settling disputes among members in addition to other activities. Below the General Council are many committees that specialize in the complex issues of trade in goods, services, and intellectual property. Decisions in the WTO are generally made by consensus, meaning all members must agree, and all members have an equal vote. The latest disputes over U.S. tariffs have set off measures and countermeasures by the countries, including China, the EU, and Canada. Mexico is one of the countries the U.S. has included in its WTO dispute action. Mexico's economy ministry said the country would defend itself in the trade body against the latest U.S. actions. The ministry said in a statement, U.S. purchases of Mexican steel and aluminum do not represent a national security threat to that country. I'm Mario Ritter.
Eritrea reopened its embassy in Ethiopia on Monday. The official reopening came a week after the two sides declared an end to 20 years of a military stalemate. The countries fought a border war in which tens of thousands of people died. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki attended the event Monday in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital. Abiy officially gave the keys to the embassy to Afwerki. The embassy's reopening marked the end of the Eritrean leader's three-day visit to Ethiopia. On Sunday, Abiy and Isaias attended a concert in Addis Ababa. The show was organized to celebrate a peace agreement between their countries. Thousands of people cheered as the two leaders put their arms around the other as a sign of friendship. Hate, discrimination, and conspiracy is now over, Afwerki told Ethiopians. We are ready to move forward with you as one. No one can steal the love we have regained now. When we say we have reconciled, we mean we have chosen a path of forgiveness and love, Abiy said. Abiy took office in April. He is Ethiopia's first leader from the Oromo ethnic group. The Oromos have led 3 years of anti-government protests that left hundreds dead. On Saturday, thousands of people stood along the streets of Addis Ababa, some waving Eritrean flags to celebrate the visit. Last week, Abiy traveled to Asmara, Eritrea's capital, where the two leaders signed the agreement ending the state of war. In addition to reopening their embassies, the two sides agreed to build ports and restart flights between their countries. They also agreed to permit the reuniting of families that have been divided by the conflict. Under the peace agreement, Ethiopia will surrender disputed border areas to Eritrea. Eritrea was part of Ethiopia until it broke away. It declared independence in 1993. Eritrea has long been a target of international sanctions. The United Nations Security Council approved the measures because of the country's suspected support of extremists. The Eritrean government also has been accused of human rights violations. Thousands of Eritreans have fled the country to escape poverty and avoid required military service. Leaders of both Ethiopia and Eritrea hope the peace deal will lead to more economic development. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
High school students in the U.S. increasingly have a new option to challenge themselves, the International Baccalaureate, or IB. The program is a demanding two-year curriculum. It aims to prepare students for college-level work, support independent research, and teach the value of a diverse world. To earn an IB diploma, students must spend their third and fourth year of high school in the program. It requires the ability to use English as well as the study of another language. It also requires classes in math, science, social science, art, a class on theory of knowledge, a 4,000-word paper, presentations, and 150 recommended hours of community service. Colleen Duffy is the marketing manager for the International Baccalaureate Organization in the Americas. She said what many people do not understand about IB is that it is not a study abroad program. Students do not travel to a different country to study. Rather, it was created in Switzerland for families who often moved from one country to another and wanted an internationally accepted curriculum. The program began in 1968. But we're in public schools in almost every U.S. state now, says Duffy. Currently, IB is offered in more than 900 American high schools. As Duffy noted, the majority are public schools, and the program is most common in the states of California, Florida, and Texas. But many more schools across the U.S. have begun the long certification process. However, it is still much less common than another option for high-performing students in the U.S., advanced placement classes. AP classes are single-subject classes that permit students to earn college credit if they do well enough on a final test. But Colleen Duffy argues that IB better shows how subjects are related. She says it's much more holistic than a few AP classes here and there. Critics say the IB program is not for every student or every community. Kelly Osterhout taught middle school in Virginia for 4 years. She says she believed in the IB program, but still fought against having it at her school. She thought it was too difficult to follow the state school requirements while still running an IB program. She says, "We felt that there weren't enough resources available to teachers to do it the way it should be done, and we had to deal with parents who got upset about elements of the program, like teaching global tolerance and respecting the opinions of others. Just mentioning the LGBTQ movement, for example, caused a stir." Teachers at her school voted to remove the IB program at the middle school level, but it remains in place at the high school. Other people feel uncomfortable with the program's connection to the United Nations. The program received money from UNESCO from 1968 until 1976 and continues to be linked with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. Others object to its cost. The organization charges $11,650 a year per school, $172 per student, and $119 per exam. Critics say AP classes are less costly and likely to reach more students since the IB curriculum is too difficult for most. Yet IB is gaining popularity in the U.S. and around the world. Currently, IB schools total more than 4,700 among 150 countries. About 2,000 more schools are expected to add the program in the next 5 years.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is full of examples of leaders joining together to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. Both leaders also shared a love of history and nature and the sea. Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I, but neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill and between the United States and Britain led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain. And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed. On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much, as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union, and he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta conference.
I come from the Crimea Conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea Conference. The first was to bring the peace of Germany with the greatest possible speed and the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war. It would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wished to live in honorable friendship. "I also know that their word is honest," Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta Conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany. And the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow. Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, also ended a deep personal friendship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear in future programs, it was a world that few people expected.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.